This is only a game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
I mean, if you have Mac and goal, like, you gotta work hard still, but you can trust him that he's yelling at you, like, to get in the right position and making sure your team doesn't give up easy goals.
Quinn Murphy, a 13-year-old soccer player, knows the value of a good goalkeeper. So did Vladimir Nabokov. He once wrote, "The goalkeeper is the lone eagle, the last defender, less the keeper of a goal than the keeper of our dreams." Nabokov didn't have Mac Brady in mind, not literally at least. He was dead long before Mac was born. But hold what Mr. Nabokov said in mind anyway, okay? Just humor me. Anyway, according to Mac's mother, Elizabeth Brady, the love of soccer came early to her son.
He has an older sister, Izzy, who's about 6 years older than he is. And we were actually taking Izzy to a soccer summer camp, but he was too young. And when we got there, Izzy decided, "I'm not sure this is for me." And he was standing there in the midst of, you know, the soccer camp, and he, I think he was probably two. And he was like, "I will stay. I will stay. I'll go in her place." This is something he loved, and he would be in the backyard and with his soccer ball and, you know, always had his ball with him. So we just went with his energy.
Mac's energy sometimes complicated things for his family, such as when everybody was expected at a wedding that conflicted with the schedule of the State College Celtics, the youth soccer team in Pennsylvania for which Mac, then seven, was playing.
Suddenly you're like, wait a minute, is soccer taking over our lives? Shouldn't he be at the family wedding? And yet he was so sincere about needing to be in Pittsburgh with his team. I wrestled with this for a couple weeks, and Mac would kind of come up to me and say, "Shavi, made a decision yet? I need to be with my team." We said, "Okay, you go." And he carpooled with, you know, one of the other family teams, and we were at the wedding, and then there was this reception, getting just text after text after text, you know, play by play of what was happening. And Mac just emerged that day, just came into his own, I think. And we've often mused on the fact that we weren't there, but we honored him.
And, of course, thanks to contemporary technology, you were sort of there because your phone kept pinging.
Absolutely. We were, you know, the annoying relatives at the reception with our phone under the table.
Mac didn't just love soccer. Unlike almost every other small child crazy about that game, Mac fell in love with goaltending. His dad, Christian Brady, a former water polo goalie, was pleased.
"I tried my best and failed many times to be a quiet parent on the sideline, but at home we would work a little bit on angles and mindset. I would talk with him, you know, 5, 6 years old, about only worry about the balls in front of you, don't worry about the balls behind you, and so forth. And for whatever reason, he liked being responsible for the defense of his goal. He liked being back there for his teammates. I once taught him to tell your players where the ball is and tell them to cover weak side. And next thing I know in the game, you hear, "Weak, weak, weak."
Because Christian Brady is a professor and former dean at Penn State University, and because his job has acquainted him with the men's soccer coach there and lots of the players, Christian and Mac went to lots of Penn State soccer games together. There, Mac studied goalkeeping at the college level.
It always amazed me, actually, how the very next game he would play, I would see something that one of our Penn State keepers had done that Mac was now incorporating in his own play, which is remarkable because half the time I'd be watching the game intently and he'd be talking with his buddies or doing something else, but he was clearly paying attention at some point.
According to one of Mac's teammates, John Kobus, clutch didn't begin to describe Mac's play. Kobus says Mac could be funny, even goofy, but every time you needed a save, it just didn't get past him. Mac's plan was to play one day at Penn State. Excellence there would put him on the U.S. national team's radar, and he hoped he'd also gain the attention of his favorite pro team, Real Madrid. Childhood is for dreaming. In the aftermath of Christmas 2012, it all seemed possible for an 8-year-old goalkeeper. And then, after a day of sledding and playing in the snow, Mac started to run a fever. Neither of his parents thought it was serious. One of Mac's pals had some flu symptoms and recovered overnight. But Elizabeth and Christian called the doctor just to be safe.
So they said, just call us back tomorrow morning if he still has a fever. So 7:38 in the morning on New Year's Eve morning, call them. And they said, yeah, okay, bring him in at 4:30 this afternoon. So then I took him into the doctor's and, you know, in hindsight, I realized that the first physician there, he clearly realized something more was wrong. And Bill, I'll do my best on details here. But within about 45 minutes, he said, you really need to take Mac to the ER. I'm going to call over. I'll get there, I promise. So so they bring him into the ER. You know, they didn't really know what was going on. They were trying to do blood work and so forth. And after a few hours, they said, there's just not much that we can do here. We need to life flight him to a hospital. So they bundled him up on the stretcher, and the helicopter crew came and got him. We prayed with him, and we stood outside and watched the helicopter take off. I took a video because I knew he'd want to see the helicopter he'd been in.
Mac never would see the video. He died in the helicopter as his parents were driving from State College to Hershey.
When he wasn't in the intensive care unit, I had a hunch that things weren't good, and the chaplain came and met us and took us to the quiet room. And I told Elizabeth, I said, he's gone. And she said, how do you know? And I'm trained as an Episcopal priest and ordained, and I said, they don't bring the chaplain to the quiet room when things are going well.
Sepsis had shut down Mac's organs so quickly that even the doctors who saw him in State College had no chance to save him. Christian remembered later that one doctor had told him it could be like somebody striking a match in a dry forest. Once she'd absorbed the initial shock, Elizabeth Brady began thinking about Mac's 15-year-old sister, who'd stayed home while her parents had made the drive to Hershey.
I said to the chaplain, what do I do? Do I call Izzy? Or what do I do? And she said, no, go to her. So we went to her friend's house and banged on the doors. Everyone was sleeping. And finally, her friend's father came down and answered the door. And he said, I'm sorry to wake you, but we just need to get Izzy. And so we were able to kind of rouse her and bring her down and tell her in person, you know. And I think about that because later she remembered that was important to her, you know.
With Izzy, Christian and Elizabeth mourned Mac's death, and then almost without a pause, they celebrated his life. They were determined to help Mac's teammates deal with the loss of their pal, their goalkeeper. Penn State coach Bob Warming remembers hearing Christian's concerns about the kids.
And a lot of them obviously were very sad and in shock in some ways. And some of them thought they didn't know if they wanted to play soccer again, just because they associated soccer with Mac.
Christian Brady's concern led to the creation of an annual clinic for Mac's teammates and other soccer players in the community. Members of the Penn State varsity and a couple of players who'd graduated, one of whom was playing professional soccer, staged a day to celebrate Mac and his love for the game.
Well, the very first clinic was only, gosh, like not even 2 weeks after Mac died. And I think initially there's such an energy to be there, and there was some comfort, I think, in coming together and seeing the boys out there playing. And of course, Mac should have been there. I mean, it's so poignant all the time. But I think that's the kind of that flip side, and always the both and, is that being isolated from that or stepping away from something that Mac loved, I don't think that would have been healthy for anyone, you know? And so I think by emerging, you know, and kind of embracing and stepping back into the energy of it all was his healing, certainly for us, but I think healing for everybody.
the Brady family established a fund to benefit the recruiting and training of future goalkeepers at Penn State, and the Penn State team decided that one game each year should be designated the Mac Brady game. As it happens, Penn State has never lost the Mac Brady game, and from time to time that game has featured an inexplicable moment, at least according to Christian Brady.
Year before last, I'm pretty sure it was Indiana that we played. We were about 14 minutes in, and of course it was a horrible call, a penalty kick, because it was against my team. We thought this is not a good start. Matt Bersano was in the goal for us, and they get on the line, player comes up to the spot, Matt dives to the left, gets his left hand on the ball, blocks it, and they win 1-0 by the end of the game. I think that was the final score. And Coach Warming, he turned around after that penalty stop and hugged me so tight I lost all breath, and he said, "Mac, that's all Mac." It's a pretty good feeling, isn't it?
Thanks to the love and determination of Mac's parents and of various people, young and old, whom he touched during his short life, all sorts of grand and surprising things have come about in the wake of that life. And Elizabeth Brady has found in these positive developments and more a capacity for serenity.
I would much rather be standing in the sidelines bundled up in a sweatshirt watching Mac, you know. But that wasn't our choice. So Mac's legacy, in a sense, with his friends and everything, is one of energy and pride and excitement instead of our grief, you know, as it should be.
Elizabeth Brady doesn't deny the grief. "We will always be the parents of two children," she told me. She's not someone who feels one can get over the death of a child. "You learn to carry it," she says, "and in creating ways to sustain the enthusiasm they treasured in their son and to celebrate their love for him to the benefit of many others, she and her family have carried it, and they've done so much more." You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Dee Wilma for leaving the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. What a wonderful discovery. I am not the fan in the family, but my wife is. Every week we listen to the episodes together and laugh at the stories. I have liked it on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook, Twitter, and an iTunes review? Wow, Dee Wilma, terrific. Tell you what, if you too have followed us on Facebook and Twitter and left a review of the show on iTunes, let us know. A Facebook message would do the job nicely, and we'll send you back a little something from the OAG swag closet. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. This week, I learned something very sad about one of our regulars on this segment. Will Leach of Sports on Earth is a Knicks fan. That's not sad for me, sad for Will. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Will and by Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports, both via Skype. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Always good to be here.
Will, my condolences, and why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I almost had a way out of it this week, Bill, and I didn't take it. Well, a large part of my career, generally speaking, I consider almost like my beat to be fandom, you know, writing about fandom, about other people's fandom, about my own fandom, and kind of the fundamental tenet of my whole writing about fandom is that you don't switch teams. You don't abandon your teams. No matter how bad it gets, this is just something fundamental and core to who you are, and you can't drop that. Boy, did the Knicks press that this week. The idea, Phil Jackson, Phil, whatever your thoughts about Phil Jackson, I think as a coach he has his bona fides, as a general manager, decidedly less so. There's one thing that all 29 of the other NBA GMs have in common. They would never trade Kristaps Porzingis because they are not crazy people. So I wrote for Sports on Earth this week. I put it on the line, do the one thing I vowed I would never do. If the Knicks traded Kristaps Porzingis, I would renounce my Knicks fandom. It's the one thing after Isaiah Thomas, after everything that's going on with this franchise, is the one thing that would make me renounce it. Phil Jackson gave me a reprieve from the governor by not trading Kristaps Porzingis for now. However, I have to say, I kind of think that ultimately the meanest thing that Phil Jackson could have done was not do the thing that would have let me let loose of the Knicks.
Yeah, would have let you off the hook. Absolutely.
First of all, I think it's hilarious that Phil Jackson is now like literally tormenting multiple generations of Knicks fans and ruining their hopes and dreams. That's tremendous. And if this was all some sort of inside job sabotage, I would not be surprised. In terms of trading Porzingis, I mean, that's Will's right. It's crazy. In some ways, you know, draft night, the Knicks get an A++++ just by not trading him. I don't even know who they took with their draft pick. It doesn't really matter that much. I do feel what Will's saying about the once you're a fan, you can't stop being a fan of a team. You know, I think there's a kind of a doomed romance to that if you're a Knicks fan. But I also think at some point in life, like with everything in life, there's a point where you should cut your losses. And I do think Knicks fans should at least consider taking a break. You can always come back later, but maybe just take a break for a few years or a decade or so.
You know, I grew up in New Jersey, and I'm the guy who has broken your rule, Will, because I was a Knicks fan back in the days of Walt Frazier, Dave DeBuscher, Willis Reed, and Bill Bradley, and that was a great team to root for. All you have to do to stop being a fan of the team that you grew up following is move. Move somewhere else.
We live in an on-demand world, Bill. I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan here in Georgia, and as far as my children know, we live next door to Busch Stadium. There's Cardinals stuff everywhere in this house, and the game is constantly playing. I can make them believe they live next to the Garden, only a little bit quieter.
Patrick, I invite you to move us on to the topic of star basketball players who aren't getting paid, at least for now.
Right. So my story is one that I wrote for Vice Sports. Shameless plug, really. The idea is simple, and this is it. Historically black colleges and universities should start a pay-for-play basketball league with no amateur restrictions. They should go out and scoop up lots of the best high school and even college players. And they should essentially create a new model for college sports. Now, this plan comes from Andy Schwarz, who's an economist that worked on the Ed O'Bannon case, mm-hmm. where you saw former and current athletes suing the NCAA in federal court over trying to profit from their name, image, and likenesses. Andy Schwarz looked at this and he figured these legal challenges are not working just yet. They're not working fast enough. What if there's a way to take on the NCAA cartel the old-fashioned way, by actual competition? To take on any cartel, you got to look at people that are part of it who really aren't benefiting from it. And that's where the HBCUs come in. The HBCUs have fallen further and further behind in terms of facilities, finances, and they have a lot to gain by trying something different. And it could really work. You really just need a broadcaster that's willing to pay for this, and sponsors and investors. They figure the startup cost to be about $30 to $50 million. But look at it this way. Let's say you're a top high school recruit. You're being offered a quality education, national exposure, campus with a great community and tradition, the freedom to actually pursue commercial endorsement opportunities. You don't have to deal with the NCAA's annoying rules, and you're getting a salary of $50,000 to $100,000 a year. That's not a bad deal.
I think that it is a wonderful concept and a wonderful idea. And there are so many forces aligned against this. I thought there was a terrific story, Patrick. And one of the things you brought up that the league would really need would be like a figurehead or someone that was well known in the basketball community with a lot of money, like say a LeBron James. For me, this seems like a wonderful post-retirement project for LeBron James to be the front end of this league, a guy that has no connection to the world of college basketball and therefore and knows how this works entirely. To me, the saddest part of the story was the idea that even if this got going, it would be difficult for the HBCU schools, because when someone like North Carolina AT&T got a recruit that North Carolina wanted, they would go complain to the legislature. Like that is, there's just something about that idea that even if one of the small schools started to get a little advantage, they just go to the legislature and go to the government and try to make them stop them. This is such a wonderful concept idea. I think it just requires so many people willing to buck the system that I keep waiting for more and more people to do that.
Well, I'm in favor of bucking the system. First of all, it includes compensation for the players, which I think is basic. Beyond that, it would cause the heads of a lot of people at NCAA headquarters in Indianapolis to explode, and that would be good. And finally, it would rob at least some of the multimillionaire college coaches of the players they covet. So put me down as a yes for this. Patrick, why don't you wrap this up for us?
Will is right. There are a lot of obstacles to this. There's cultural obstacles. There's financial obstacles, potentially legal obstacles. If the dominant Power Five schools went to their state legislatures and told them, you know, make this stop somehow, they could put a lot of pressure on HBCUs. They could put funding pressure on them. So there is a lot to overcome. But I will say this. If it was 1995 and someone's saying, hey, let's take on Microsoft, people would laugh at you. But I don't think anyone's laughing at Google, Apple, Facebook anymore. Disruption always starts with a crazy sounding idea.
All right. I'd like to talk a little about blood and drugs. Over the past 9 years, three players, count them three, on the PGA Tour have been suspended for using performance-enhancing drugs. One of them, actually, Scott Stallings, never failed a drug test. He turned himself in when he learned that a prescription he'd been using after he'd been injured contained an element on the PGA's banned list because apparently that's the sort of thing golfers do.
The golfiest thing ever.
Yes, one of the golfiest things ever. You're right. Anyway, this week the PGA announced that blood and not just urine would be tested. Golfers are going to have to submit to these invasive tests. Three suspensions in 9 years does not sound to me like a crisis, and I wonder if this is absolutely necessary. Feels to me like one more solution in search of a problem, kind of like coming down on voter fraud that isn't happening. Does anybody want to defend the PGA on this?
I will never want to defend the PGA on anything. You know, like a lot of other sports, this feels like another one of those. We've got a testing thing in place, but all told, we'd rather not make it look like we have a problem. So it feels like a lot of testing programs. If you are very, very sloppy, they will catch you. But if you're not and you actually know what's going on, you'll be able to elude all the testing if you decide to take the drugs while still letting the league say, oh, we're taking a stand on this.
I mean, Will's 100% right. I mean, drug testing in sports are generally IQ tests. I mean, that's kind of how they work for a lot of different reasons. And they're mechanisms of public relations. And the ideal drug testing program for a sports league catches a few people, but not too many. So I also don't think necessarily golf has a huge PED issue. I'm not sure golf that there's a like humongous amount of drugs that would actually help you be that much better at it. Now, maybe there are things that help with calming nerves that could help you. I know golfers are fitter now than they used to be. Maybe there's some stuff you can take that helps you train and recover better. But for the most part, I agree with you, Bill. This does seem like a solution in search of an actual problem.
For what it's worth, if they did allow them to use PEDs, I might find golf more fun to watch.
Bigger, more ripped golfers would be more fun to watch.
I mean, they're having a hard time getting me now.
For the record, when NPR falls into line and starts testing all of us, I'm okay with it. Test me every day. I have nothing to hide, just in case I'd previously given anybody some other impression.
Does that go for guests?
You know, does it mean you'll never talk to me again if I say yes?
Bye, I have to go. Bye.
Guys, caffeine used to be on WADA's banned list.
Oh.
I think they might even be bringing it back in certain quantities. So we should all be careful joking about this.
Yeah, I was going to say, then they don't even have to test me. All they have to do is look at the cup on my desk.
Just look at my eyes.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Will Leach of Sports on Earth and Patrick Gruby of Vice Sports. Thanks to both of you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Energy. Where does it come from and where does it go? For the last two decades or so, a household in Fort Wayne, Indiana has generated enormous amounts of it, maybe gigawatts. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story of how that energy came to be unleashed on the sports world and beyond.
The trouble began not long after Nancy Lefevre's twin boys started to walk.
Connor and Reese pulled a grandfather clock on top of them when they were 18 months. They had to have stitches and everything, and from that point on, at least once a year, one of my guys had to have stitches or broke a bone or something. It was nonstop.
But the real fun began when Riley, born just 2 years after his brothers, became old enough to join the shenanigans.
We had a little balcony over our living room, and we'd go up to the top of the balcony and jump off onto our couches.
Time to send the kids outside. Probably no dangerous balconies there, right?
In our backyard, we had a pool, and we also had a balcony over our pool.
Sounds dangerous, but no need to worry. There, as always, to ensure the boys' safety was Nancy's husband, Kent.
He threw them from the deck into the pool.
When they got older, they also launched themselves from the balcony over the pool.
It was a pretty good jumping. We'd probably get it by a couple inches, but to us, that was like clearing it.
In one side-splitting episode, Nancy's guys waited for her to get home. Connor writhed in mock agony on the concrete deck, as if he had missed the water. Riley remembers getting yelled at for that one. And then there was the Harry Houdini escape act.
They used to love to tie each other up with rope, their hands, their feet, everything, jump into the pool and see how long it took them to become untied.
Man.
And the boys' friends would come, and they would see these kids underwater and start freaking out. It's like, oh, no, he's got plenty of time. Don't worry about it. And if I jumped in to try to save them, if I thought they'd been down there too long, oh, then they were mad at me.
And who wouldn't be mad at a killjoy mom like Nancy? But sometimes she got a little mad, too.
There were times when I drove home from work, and I would see them. I just wanted to drive on by and pretend like I didn't live there.
But she had to come home. If she didn't, who'd repair the house?
Oh, yes, I was constantly repairing holes in the walls. It was just like, oops, Mom will have to fix that. Oops, Mom will have to fix that.
There was one time when I was wrestling with my brother Connor, and we weren't even really wrestling that hard, it seemed like, but one of us tripped and fell in right in front of our TV, put a big hole in the wall, right in our living room.
Right beside the television, so everyone that came in saw it. And I finally said, okay, I'm done. I'm not fixing it anymore. People can come and they can see exactly how destructive you guys are.
Signing the boys up for every available sport hadn't done much to stop the mayhem. Their barbarian zeal had reached critical mass. So had Nancy's frustration.
Once we got older around middle school, my mom just was sick of it.
We got a wrestling mat in our basement.
So it became our little wrestling room.
And they started wrestling when they weren't at school and they weren't outside, they were practicing in the basement.
Riley and his twin brothers were still putting holes in walls downstairs, but they were also learning a sport that would soon lead them away from the furniture and the pool and into middle school gyms. Nancy must have loved that the boys were now wrestling elsewhere, right?
I hated it with a passion.
My dad loved it. She thought we'd get hurt, thought something would happen.
Something did happen. Lots of good things. All three boys became successful high school wrestlers. In 2012, Connor and Reese were named captains of the Wabash University wrestling team. 2 years later, Riley followed them to Wabash and developed a reputation for toying with his overmatched opponents.
He would take them down, let them back up. Take them down, let them back up. Take them down, and I'm sure half the time the other kid would just think, oh, please just pin me, get it done and over with.
That's what my family always thinks I'm doing. They think I'm just messing with guys, trying to humiliate them. But in all honesty, to me, it's just wrestling. I'm trying to get the most out of every single match.
And, you know, I'd say, Riley, don't do that. That doesn't look nice. He said, Mom, wrestling isn't a sport to be nice.
Nancy says she finally learned to appreciate wrestling when her boys were in college. She even learned to love it. She became the Wabash wrestling team's unofficial photographer. But Nancy was in for yet another surprise.
When he went on to, you know, major in English, it's like, ooh, is that really what you want to do? And he says, yeah, I really enjoy it, Mom.
He was already a successful student athlete. He became a poet.
A lot of people would see it as a contradiction, you know, a rugged sport, a combat sport versus poetry, which is sort of seen as a high art. I guess you sort of think of like people sitting in their desk writing poetry with like a pipe or something like that. But I don't think of it that way.
And it shows in his poetry. This poem's called The Seventh Circle of Hell is Violence. I challenge you to go 7 minutes versus another man, to fight in every position and give him an inch, to battle control of each on your feet. Take him down to hell. You know he's just gotten himself into hell, because every wrestler knows you can't really win if you can't escape from the bottom. Nancy Lefevre says she appreciates Riley's poems and the discipline it takes to write them.
Yeah, it's funny sometimes when I read them and I'm thinking, wow, my son actually wrote that. I'm impressed.
And nothing gets destroyed. No, nothing gets destroyed. In fact, a lot of things have been built. Reese is a full-time assistant coach for Wabash Wrestling. Connor is working for a logistics company. In March, Riley won his fourth NCAA title. Only one other Division III wrestler has ever done that. He graduated in May with a degree in English and a 3.43 GPA. The following day, Wabash University celebrated the first annual Riley Lefevre Day. Now he's hoping to make the 2020 Olympic team, and he's getting married in August. As for Nancy, she doesn't want to get too far ahead of things, but
I'm hoping for a granddaughter sometime since I've never had daughters myself, but in my heart, I really am looking forward to the day when I can see a grandson out there on the wrestling mat.
Considering Nancy Lefevre's experiences as the only woman living in a house full of man children hell-bent on self-inflicted injury and home demolition, should she really be wishing for grandsons? For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
Just ahead on Only a Game.
The throw to the plate will be late. The Mariners are going to play for the American League Championship.
How the Seattle Mariners, Walter Matthau, and the Peanuts Gang contributed to one of the greatest video game characters of all time. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, inside the Balco doping scandal with a man who was responsible for it, Victor Conti. But first, it's time to discuss this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NBA draft came and went on Thursday. How do you like how the top three picks shook out?
Well, I think the Celtics was a bit of a surprise. I mean, they've been throwing around Jackson's name for the better part of a week, and then they went with Jason Tatum from Duke. I think they're probably interchangeable. You know, I think that basically having, what was it, 11 freshmen in a row go is an interesting commentary on the one-and-done phenomenon, which I believe is going to be, if not one, certainly done once the NBA puts itself together again.
Markelle Fultz as the number one pick, probably not a surprise. Likewise, L.A. number two, Lonzo Ball, probably not a surprise. How deep do we have to go to get a real surprise?
Well past all the freshmen, I think. And that's the interesting thing. I think one of the biggest surprises was Malik Monk from Kentucky dropping all the way to Charlotte into double figures in the lottery. You know, I think that was probably the biggest surprise of the early part of the draft.
The biggest bombshell of the night came when the Chicago Bulls traded star forward Jimmy Butler to Minnesota for what seems to me, anyway, to have amounted to a couple of point guards, one of them injured, and a project center. The general consensus, it's not just me, is that Chicago got fleeced. What do you think?
You're absolutely right about that, and so is everyone else you've been reading. This is going to go down in history as one of the really bad trades. And I'll tell you what, the Minnesota Timberwolves are going to be fun to watch next year.
My favorite pre-draft story comes out of New York, where Knicks general manager Phil Jackson reportedly dozed off during a pre-draft workout of a top prospect. So look out, NBA world. Here come the resurgent Knicks.
Yeah, Phil is draining his reputation as an NBA savant pretty quickly during his tenure in New York. Nothing is working out for Phil at this point.
After three consecutive appearances in the NBA Finals, the Cleveland Cavaliers have fired their general manager, David Griffin. Does anybody think that they would have beaten the Warriors in the Finals this spring if they'd had a different general manager?
Well, apparently, you know, Dan Gilbert does, and he owns the team, and that's the and that's one of the big problems
this.
They have there. No, I mean, this was completely out of the blue, and I think will prove to be a really bad move.
The NHL held its expansion draft this week, Charlie. How'd the Las Vegas Golden Knights make out? And please don't say they hit the jackpot.
No, but first of all, their uniforms are very cool. I like the uniforms a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And second, they got Marc-Andre Fleury, the goaltender from Pittsburgh. They're really going to be bad, though. When you build an expansion team, you either bring in players people have heard of to build an audience, or you go really young. They seem to be going down the middle on this, and I think they're going to be a really bad hockey team next year.
The NFL has a new highest-paid player, at least according to one measure. Does quarterback Derek Carr of the Raiders merit that distinction?
Well, I mean, he's a quarterback who can play the position, who is up for a contract. And that's all you need to do to get that particular distinction. You know, as Charlie Weiss told me a long time ago, at any one time on planet Earth, there are about 13 guys who can play the position competently in the NFL. And, you know, that's just competently. You know, David Carr is more than competent. So, I mean, you know, it was his turn, basically.
Atlanta Falcons running back Devontae Freeman said this week that he would have been the Super Bowl MVP if he had gotten the ball more often. This does not seem to me a great strategy for getting the ball more often.
Well, the Atlanta coaching staff didn't cover itself with glory in the second half of that game, but still, Devontae, I mean, it's a little late to be coming to this conclusion, isn't it?
Chicago Bears season ticket holder Russell Beckman has sued the Bears because he says the team denied him access to a 2016 pregame event at Soldier Field, and the reason is because he was wearing Packers green and yellow on that day. For the record, Beckman is also a Packers season ticket holder. Wait a minute. He holds season tickets for both teams, so how can you be two places at once when you're not anywhere at all?
What kind of a jump do you take me for? I think this is a meritless lawsuit, but I am looking forward to reading the amicus brief from Aaron Rodgers.
And finally, Charlie, Jim Entwistle tweeted recently that his favorite mug, the Bayern Munich mug out of which he liked to drink his tea, was faded and it was cracked after 20 years of use and he had to retire it. And then the team sent him a replacement mug and thanked him for his loyalty. So that's pretty cool, huh?
I think Mr. Entwistle deserves to be flown to Germany to go to a game.
I don't think
he should settle for the mug. I think he should be incredibly greedy.
Meanwhile, I'm going to tweet at the Pittsburgh Pirates that my Honus Wagner baseball card is a bit faded. And see, you think it'll work?
hey, you know what? The more I look at this ticket stub from the 1962 Celtics, the more I think, gee, you know, it's really kind of bent at the edges. Maybe I should, like, get another one.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, so first of all, could you just introduce yourself?
My name is Ryan Fitzgerald. I am the intern at Only a Game.
Ryan is actually no longer our intern, but he and Only a Game producer Martin Kessler recorded this conversation about a month ago because something exciting happened at the office. Here's Martin.
As the youngest member of the Only a Game staff, I tend to miss a lot of cultural references. Lines from old movies and Bob Dylan songs, recollections of ancient technologies like typewriters. But on that day a month ago, Ryan and I talked about something the rest of the Only a Game staff knew nothing about.
I remember playing backyard baseball for many hours on my computer. I thought it was the coolest game ever.
If you were a sports fan born in the 90s, you probably also thought backyard baseball was the coolest game ever. It was a computer game, and instead of starring pro players, the game featured cartoon children. Cartoon children who could blast 400-foot home runs. The character that Ryan and I remembered most vividly was named Pablo Sanchez.
And I just remember, like, he'd come up to bat, and the bat would be, like, almost the same size as him.
After that conversation with Ryan, I checked with some friends to see what they remembered about backyard baseball.
I remember Pablo.
Pablo is like Babe Ruth crossed with Mike Trout, crossed with Sandy Koufax.
But crossed with like all the pudgy kids that you grew up with.
If I remember correctly, the shirt did not cover his entire belly.
He had like pretty maxed out stats. He crushed, man. He was the coolest.
So Pablo Sanchez was the star. He was pudgy, short, but there was something else that everyone mentioned.
And he only spoke Spanish. As far as I can remember, he only spoke Spanish.
Also because I took Spanish, I was like, oh, yeah, cool. I could have been friends with him.
These days, you hear a lot, probably not enough, about the shortage of minority characters in children's books, games, and movies. Yet, here was this hit computer game from 20 years ago that starred a Hispanic character who's still popular today. We started to wonder, how did that happen? Who invented Pablo Sanchez? And why? Pablo's roots can be traced all the way back to a makeshift field in Olympia, Washington.
First base is the chimney. If you hit it into the neighbor's yard, it's an automatic out, and you have to go get it.
Nick Merkovich grew up playing wiffle ball with his neighborhood friends, and he went on to work for a video game company in Seattle called Humongous Entertainment. It specialized in adventure games for younger kids. There was Freddy Fish, which starred an anthropomorphic fish detective, and Putt-Putt, which featured a talking purple car. Nick liked all those games, but when he got home, he played something else.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to John Madden Football.
During the 90s, a company called EA Sports started releasing a slew of popular sports games aimed at teenagers and adults. One weekend, on a drive from Olympia to Seattle, Nick got an idea. Why not make a sports game for younger kids? He wrote up a one-page proposal for a baseball game, ran it by a friend, and turned it into his bosses the next day. And then, he didn't hear anything. Months went by. Nick forgot about it.
And then all of a sudden, this is a strange thing that happened, the Mariners started doing great.
The throw to the plate will be late. The Mariners are going to play for the American League Championship.
In 1995, the Seattle Mariners reached the MLB playoffs for the first time in franchise history.
It was kind of a big thing here in Seattle. And the studio head kind of got pulled into that, I think.
Maybe it was just a coincidence, but Nick's baseball game idea suddenly got the green light. By that point, Nick was already working on another project. So the ball ended up in the hands of a programmer named Rich Moe.
I actually never really played baseball growing up, so I was the least qualified one of the bunch.
And an artist named Mark Pizer.
I think it had to do with the availability of others, because I would not have been anyone's first choice.
So with that fearsome duo at the top of the lineup, the project began. Understandably, Mark and Rich had some concerns. For one, as Rich recalls, nobody had bothered to check whether there was interest in a sports game for younger kids.
We had no idea. This was back in the day when we didn't have a large army of market researchers. I don't think we did a focus group, period.
Second, the company's technology was meant for simpler point-and-click adventure games, not a sports game.
I was instantly thinking, how are we going to pull this off? And how could we go head-to-head against EA? They are the dominant force in the sports game industry.
So the two guys who didn't know baseball, without any market research or proper technology, started thinking.
We quickly saw that the game here was not to beat EA at their own game. It was to take it in a different tangent.
Their plan? Here's Mark.
It really started with the characters. I mean, that's the biggest part.
Rich, Mark, and Nick, who, thanks to sharing an office with Mark, still ended up at meetings, decided their game could stand out if they made characters little kids could relate to. EA Sports could have pro athletes. Backyard Baseball would have the girl with the backwards hat who was always chewing bubble gum and the cool rocker guy who wore big headphones to the plate.
We were thinking, okay, we're going to do baseball. I think there's like, what, 9 people on a baseball team? Something like that? And so, well, how many characters are we going to develop? We have to have 18 at least. It ramped up from there, though, because we wanted to have alternates. It only took a little while of discussion before we said, okay, we're going to develop 30 kids.
What was your reaction to that?
It seemed like a lot. It seemed like a lot of kids, 30.
So they brainstormed. They thought about kids they grew up with. Mark knew a kid who used a wheelchair, so they added an ace pitcher with a wheelchair. And maybe they added some characters based on themselves. One character, Reese Worthington, happens to have asthma, just like Rich. And for more inspiration, they turned to movies and TV shows like Sandlot and Peanuts.
And then we also talked about the Bad News Bears.
There is no limit to what some men will do for money, especially a man like Morris Buttermaker.
In that old movie, the one with Walter Matthau, I'm old, there's this scene where he's the curmudgeonly guy and he's trying to staff out his silly little league team.
All right, I don't know who the hell you are, but sit down and shut up.
Can I play second or third base?
You can play second or third, whatever you want.
There's a character in there. He was just a small Hispanic baseball player on the team, and they tended not to like really put him in. And our thinking was, what if he was the best player on the team the whole entire time?
I remember us talking about, what if we had a character like that in our game?
The one that can't speak the language and might normally not be picked is the best player.
it would be like a little secret you'd have to discover.
At that meeting, Mark started sketching. He drew a smiling boy in a V-neck t-shirt with his belly peeking out.
And do you remember why?
No. No, there's no reason why. You just do.
But the combination stuck, and Pablo Sanchez was born. They nicknamed him the secret weapon. They made him the best player and a Spanish speaker.
Hola, soy Pablo, y me gusta mucho el béisbol.
Rich says it was all part of a plan to make Pablo a character that children might initially overlook.
Was any part of you, though, thinking about, like, hey, this could be good for the world to have?
No. No, I mean, because we all bought into that idea that this is a game for everyone. But we didn't think we'd have that big of an influence. It was just a game.
It was just a game, but it turned out to be a hit, especially Pablo. He wasn't much of a secret. Everyone figured out he was a quick base runner, a solid shortstop, and a fearsome hitter. Pablo's home run song became a familiar tune in living rooms across the country. Humongous Entertainment made it into a series with other sports. Pablo, of course, continued to dominate. In 2000, they released a second edition of Backyard Baseball. But this time, Humongous added kid versions of MLB stars like Derek Jeter and Cal Ripken Jr.
A lot of people didn't like that idea, I would say. It was controversial.
That's Amy Paganini. She produced some of the later games in the Backyard series. The worry was that the pro players would overshadow the original 30. But after the sequel came out,
we would meet people that played our games and they'd say, oh, they love it was always Pablo. We love Pablo. And then they didn't say little Cal Ripken Jr. They said Pablo.
Since then, the legend of Pablo Sanchez has grown. There have been fake documentaries about his life.
Pablo Sanchez. Say the name and people around the world get excited.
Tongue-in-cheek articles have speculated about his possible steroid use. For the record, all the original designers deny those allegations. So why is Pablo Sanchez still remembered so fondly? Mark Pizer, the man who drew the first sketch of Pablo, has this theory.
It satisfies some sense of justice that we all have. You know, that it's not fair when the really super tall, big, good-looking guys are also the best at playing sports. That's not fair. You know, so let the little guy have a chance.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Philip Goldberg. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Special thanks this week to Seattle's KUOW for serving as a clubhouse for the Backyard Baseball lineup. Our final word comes from Backyard Baseball's Amy Paganini on what it's like to be asked to talk so often about a video game character who was created all the way back in 1997.
Well, it makes me feel old.
Shake it off, kid. Take it from me. You're only as old as you feel when you're trying to figure out how to turn on the computer. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.